Want to drive greater success in social commerce? With Deloitte's latest creator economy research, you can. After surveying over 500 creators and 500 brands, our insights are helping CMOs and marketing teams harness the power of content creators. And not only that, but how to do it well. See for yourself by visiting cmo.deloitte.com today. When I say DE&I, what images does that conjure for you?
Oh my God. A whole bunch of images flash before me. It flashes from Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth to Paul Robeson, to MLK, to George Floyd. It's all flashing in front of me because it's really the experiences that all of them have had and the contributions that all of them have made that allowed us to get to this point. This is not just about people of color. This is about all of us. And my hope is, and the thing that pops up is that the more people that see themselves in this, the more we all benefit from it.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion are three words that many brands and companies have been talking about a lot since the events of 2020. But DE&I has been around for more than just a year. In this mini-series, I will be talking to marketers and executives about the ways they are promoting DE&I in their organization. My guest on this episode of the CMO Podcast DE&I mini-series is Frank Cooper, the Senior Managing Director and Global Chief Marketing Officer at BlackRock. BlackRock is the world's largest asset manager, with about $9.5 trillion in assets and operates globally in 30 countries. Frank was the fourth guest on my podcast way back in 2019. And we talked then about purpose, finding passion in your work, and stepping outside your comfort zone. In this conversation, Frank shares with sincerity and passion what DE&I means to him and how BlackRock is activating its DE&I initiatives guided by its purpose. This is my engaging conversation with Frank Cooper. Frank Cooper, welcome back to the CMO Podcast. You were my fourth guest on this podcast way back in May 2019, two eventful years ago, almost to the day. And we talked at that time about your childhood, about growing up in San Francisco and LA, your career path, and of course, your team and your purpose at BlackRock. So I want to start with a loaded question today. How is your role different now, Frank, in June 2021 than it was in May 2019?
Well, Jim, well, first of all, it's great to be back. And you know, I get to say I knew him when. So I was there in the early days of this particular podcast that you have. And love it, by the way. I've been following it and listening. Thank you for providing that service. I consider it a gift. So thank you for that. It does feel like a lifetime ago in terms of life before COVID and what I was focused on. And some of those things I'm still focused on. I'm still focused on the idea of purpose. I'm still focused on digital transformation. But a few things have changed, which are fundamental shifts for me. Number one, like all crises, I think it accelerates and amplifies things that are just beneath the surface. And so while purpose was important, it became urgent. And it became urgent to really identify, not only identify what our purpose is, but making sure that we live it and making sure that it was embedded. And then dealing with the inevitable blowback that comes with taking a stand and being purpose-driven. So I found myself at the center of that and having to navigate through it and help Larry and others navigate through that. So that was one. I think it was impossible for anyone in any part of the world to miss the racial reckoning of the Black Lives Matter movement. And that had an enormous impact on my role and me personally. Most companies and their CEOs in some way felt they had to address this issue of racial inequity and diversity, equity, and inclusion. But for me, it became central to what I do at BlackRock, what I do personally, but even what I do as a marketer. And so that's been a fairly dramatic shift for me. And then the last one is, and this is also due to the pandemic, we've seen acceleration of digital adoption. So even those you might consider the late adopters and those on the periphery, they were forced in, to the pool. So everyone's in the pool now. And so now these behaviors, I think, are changing everything. And so you're seeing a faster evolution of certain platforms like TikTok is moving quickly toward providing, I think, meaningful knowledge and skills. And you couldn't say that before the pandemic. I think you're seeing commerce intersect with every single industry now, including financial services. And we're part of trying to understand and stay on the leading edge of how digital technology and the way in which people adopt it in their lives will impact their relationship with money, whether it's how they save it or invest it, earn it or spend it.
Frank, you used two powerful words, among many powerful words in what you just said. One was your purpose became more urgent and you had to deal with the blowback of taking a stand. Could you talk about both of those a bit more? When you say the purpose became more urgent, what do you mean by that? And what have you learned about dealing with the blowback that comes from taking a point of view?
Yeah, so our purpose became more urgent in the sense that employees in particular, but also communities, were they had higher expectations of us. And I think they had higher expectations of business overall. And it forced us to really get back to, I think, what is the most fundamental truth. People are asking, so why does business even exist? Like, we take it for granted, like, oh, this is the way it's always been. Business should always exist. And you have a right to have a corporate status, and you have a right to have favorable tax treatment, and you have a right to tap into the infrastructure. Actually, that's not exactly true. We assume that business is in some way contributing positively to life. Therefore, we give them all these privileges. And people were asking the question, is this beneficial to me? Is this industry helping me? Is this company helping me? Are they contributing in some positive way to society? And we were getting asked that question. And, are we allocating our assets in a way that actually helps the planet? Are we contributing to inequality, or are we on the side of being part of the solution? And so as we got thrust into that, we also got thrust into what I think is almost inevitably a political debate, right? Because everything today, with the backdrop of rising populism and growing inequality and shifting economic bases, all that's happening in the backdrop, almost everything's political. But certainly when you start stepping into things like racial inequity and inequality and wealth inequality, that those get political very quickly. But here's something we realized in the way that we try to navigate it, is that we realize that silence is also a moral choice. Like, people think of, you're either activist and you're acting out and you're speaking up, and that is the thing that in some way is an affirmative choice that sets you off to a path that's different from your core responsibility as a leader of a business. And they think that silence is the opposite of that, that it's inaction, but it's not. Silence is also an action, and people are recognizing that. They're saying, well, actually, silence is basically saying, I believe in the status quo, or I am supporting some of the things that I see happening in the community, and people are getting called out for it. So the realization for us was this, is that whether you decide to remain silent or neutral, or whether you decide to speak up, you will be held accountable. And so why not step up and step into the values of your company, step into your purpose, why you exist, and that becomes your compass to navigate this range of stakeholders. That becomes your compass in terms of how you take a step forward, even if it has an effect on short-term profits.
You and your team at BlackRock, over the last 2 years, especially the last year, have made some pretty strong public commitments about how you want to improve and get better in many elements of social justice, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Could you speak a bit about why those choices and those commitments, and maybe more importantly, what are you learning on the journey to meet those commitments?
Yeah, so, I mean, like all the other companies, especially particularly when George Floyd died in 2020, we held town halls, we had conversations. But again, it was a realization that while we talked about diversity, equity, and inclusion, we felt like we weren't doing enough. And then you look at the data and you say, clearly we're not doing enough. And we're not alone. I mean, it's across multiple industries. What we learned is many companies have been at this a long time and trying to move forward and trying to make progress around diversity first. You know, can I increase my numbers? And then they try to increase inclusion. You know, can I make people have a sense of belonging? And at least by my estimation, we have not done a good job. You know, and I'm not saying BlackRock. I'm saying across all industries and those who actually want to progress diversity and inclusion, we have had great intentions. We've had moments of celebration, moments of good progress. But in the end, the progress has not been great. And you can look at the numbers and it will bear that out. But what I think has changed is this. You know, one, I think you have a broader group of people who can see themselves in the other. They can see themselves in Black people and Brown people. That didn't happen before. And I'm thankful for this camera on the mobile phone, because that was the game changer, where suddenly people, it wasn't one person's word against the other. You could actually see it with your own eyes, what has happened. So there was that sense of understanding a new kind of truth of people's circumstances. There's, for whatever reason, a greater sense of empathy among a large set of people. And we focus on the exceptions. You know, we see the fighting and the combatants and all that. But the movement that I see is that people actually are trying to understand each other more. I think you see it in pop culture. Number one genre in music right now is hip hop across the world, which is an amazing thing if you think about where hip hop came from. And so I think there's this opening now where people can start to see themselves in the other. So that's one piece of it. And as they see themselves in the other, they start to realize that in helping the other, whether it's a Black person or Latinx, or whether it's Moroccan in France, or whether you know, it's some group that is other than you, you realize that you're helping yourself. And I think that is a shift that I had not seen before. So that's one key part of it. The second part of it for me is this, and a lot of it comes down to employees. The best talent, particularly the younger you go, they actually expect this as a matter of course, that of course you're going to have diversity, and of course you're going to include people and they give a sense of belonging, and of course you're not going to try to replicate decades of exclusion. Of course you're going to do that. And if you don't do it, and if it's not real, they vote with their feet. They move. And what I love about whatever you want to call the various generations, millennials, Gen X, millennials and Gen Y, what I love about it is that they're not just talking. Like, you know, I would say a lot of us, we talked a lot. And then when it came down to it, it was like really financially painful. Most would say like, okay, we're going to try to figure it out on the margins. They just walk away and say, no, that's not for me. I'm not doing it. And we're seeing that. People are coming into interviews. They expect us to have clear answers about what we're going to do in diversity, equity, inclusion, and they want to see hear clear examples of it. So Jim, a long way to say, as a result of that, we basically started to set some benchmarks ourselves. We wanted to increase our representation to 30%. You know, we started identifying the high performing in the U.S. Black and Latinx executives, and we started to build programs to help ensure that they were always on the list when it came to promotion and compensation, because those are the two most critical pain points that we've seen in terms of diverse executives, promotions and compensation. We started, and then we realized it's not only internal, it's external. We've accelerated our diverse manager program externally, so that as we're doing deals, we bring in diverse fund managers who are part of that. We are committed to and publicly announced that we are going to do a racial audit, racial equity audit next year. And so we're on the path. And so when I look at how we're doing, I'm happy that we're making progress. I think more people are aware. We need to move more quickly and we need to remain committed to it. And I'm very concerned because, again, there will be blowback in this area also. You know, I've already heard some of the language outside. Some people was saying that diversity BS, or, you know, this is like political correctness. And the cynic always seems to be more credible, right? Because it appeals to the negative side. It appeals to our survival instinct. But in this case, I think the cynic will lose long term, because there are more people who believe that this is not only the right thing to do, it's the only way forward.
What do you say to that cynic, Frank?
Oh, wow. What a great question. I would say I'm never going to try to convince you about what is fair and what is right in some moral sense. I'm not going to convince you of that. But what I would say is, as you do with any other firm-wide priority, look at the facts, look at the data, listen to people, not just the people that are next to you, listen to people who may not be like you, and then make a decision about whether or not you believe that you can thrive as a company and thrive as a leader long-term by adopting a position that seems to be regressive, at least in light of the information that you're receiving. And if you decide to stay the same, you know, bless you, I'm sure that will work out for you. But what we've seen before is that when everything else is changing and you stay the same, you will eventually become an artifact. We'll be looking at you in the museum. But if you want to adapt, here's a pathway to do it. And the last thing I'll say is this: no one's asking you or anyone else to be perfect. Proof is always in the progress. What we're saying is, wherever you're starting, where, you know, even if you think it's horrific, you know, it's like, I can't believe we're in this position, it's going to be embarrassing, it's okay. You start from that place and then you make progress. And that's when people know if you're authentic or not.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one. At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com. Frank, what's your role as CMO been in leading this change? I know it's a top team. It's a corporate-wide initiative, all people. Top team is leading it. You set the goals, the commitments. You're going to be public about it next year. How has this shifted? And we talked about your job 2 years ago. In terms of your time, your energy, your focus, how has it shifted your role as CMO?
You know, Jim, it's funny. In some cases, I don't even think of my role as CMO. I just think of my role as being an executive within BlackRock. And the time I'm investing really is in people that I believe have the potential to do great things within our company or beyond our company. And so I put a lot of time in. I'm on far too many committees, I'm sure. But I try to organize large conversations. So I've organized several of the large town halls that we've hosted here at BlackRock. I try to organize small conversations, which I think are even better, because I think proximity, Brian Stevenson talks about this a lot, this idea of proximity and not just being close to people, but really hearing their stories and sharing your story. And it's easier to be vulnerable in that setting. And I've tried to share as much of my story and my own challenges with the group. I've tried to encourage true diversity in some of these groups so that it's not just all Black or all Latinx or all women. To have a mixture there. I've tried to encourage people not to shame and blame, because that never has ever proven successful, but to listen and connect. And so I spent a lot of time, and for me, it's not marketing per se. I think we use some of the marketing skills of how do you extract information and tell stories. But it's just really about leadership. And I'm fully committed to it, because I do believe it's the right thing to do, but I'm also fully committed to it because I believe this is about unlocking potential in people and the organization. And the sad thing for me is that if we are not paying attention to how we can give people the tools that will allow them to be the best, or how to reduce the negative currents before they walk through the front door, like racial injustice or police misconduct, we're hurting ourselves and we're hurting them. And so I just see a great opportunity to do that. There is a marketing side to this, though. I do see it as I said before, I think DEI is both internal and external. As marketers, you know, as well, you know, we should be great at building narratives and telling stories and looking at data and teasing out insights from the data and sharing that with people and designing experiences. All of this is within our grasp. And so we can point that toward the employee population, which we are now doing. And we have our One BlackRock Bulletin and other things where we speak to our employees, but we can also point it to the outside world. We can start to show people a vision of what's possible for those who have been historically excluded. And, we've partnered with SeeHer, we've partnered with AIM. We're trying to be part of that movement that is getting people to rethink, some of the archetypes that have been burned into their consciousness about who can be what. And last thing I'll say this, and now I'm going on this one, but for me, one of the great, this is kind of a name drop, but I have to say this one because this one sticks out for me. I went to law school with Barack, President Obama, but I remember having this conversation with him on his 50th birthday, and I said you should be thankful to the entertainment industry. They should be your best friend. I said because I won't say it's exclusively because of the entertainment industry, but in large part the stories that were being told help people imagine and get comfortable with the idea of a Black president. Morgan Freeman as president was helpful. On the show 24, that a Black president, suddenly you normalize that. And so it reduces all of the unconscious bias that otherwise might prevent you from moving forward. I think Shonda Rhimes is the most brilliant at doing it. And so I think as marketers, we do the same thing. We're portraying images and telling stories. And these stories are getting more sophisticated over time as we move away from 30-second spots. And we have an opportunity to shape that perception of people also.
So were you a better student than President Obama, or was he a better student than you, Frank?
He is both a better student and smarter about how to translate that into a successful outcome.
You've both had great career paths.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, you and I have talked about this before. It's a mindset issue, and I'd like to get your insights from what you've been leading at BlackRock. Sometimes companies can look at DE&I and think compliance, numbers, framework, and then others look at it and think about it as growth and energy and building a better company, a higher performance company. It sounds like your mindset is much the latter, which is great. How have you built that at BlackRock?
I can't claim that we fully built it. What I can say is that we have made that mental shift and that this is not just about checking the box. It's not just about pure compliance, whether that's like a kind of official regulatory thing or otherwise. But here's some of the things we're trying to do. So one, we are, instead of putting the full burden on the diverse employee, we're now looking at the managers and we're saying, maybe the managers need to change. And so we're trying to increase training around how do you listen actively? There's a whole range of listening from kind of motivational listening to appreciative listening to active listening. But how do you do that in a way that people feel like you're fully engaged with them? How do you ask questions in a way that's humble, but still honest and authentic? We're trying to build up all these kind of empathy skills basically for managers. But the most difficult one, and this is the one that I feel like we don't have a full answer on to it, is how do you see potential in someone who may not look like you? Because what we're finding, as I mentioned earlier, two of the pain points for many diverse employees occur at promotions, and it occurs at compensation. And people always rationalize whatever decision they make. I mean, you can come up with the right language. If someone's suddenly not strategic, or someone I think we need to see a little more activity from this person in this area. They don't have enough experience. But other people, we give the benefit of the doubt and we stretch them into roles. It's because you can see the potential in them. So how do you bridge that gap? It's a very difficult thing to do. And the only thing we've come up with and this is still in motion, is you have to be willing to understand the history of people and learn about how that plays out in the world today. And so if you are somewhere where someone doesn't speak out and your position is like, well, you know, I don't see that person as a leader because that person is in the room, I've given them authority, and they don't seem to speak up, and they certainly don't challenge me or anyone else in the room. Well, that person might have, if you look at the history of that person, might have a barrier there, because they may feel like if they're perceived as speaking out, that they're too aggressive. And if they're perceived as too aggressive, they become a threat. And that may be their history. And so you have to educate people about the background and history of different types of people. But I don't have the full answer to that one. But I feel like that to me is the most of all the things I'm looking at. You can do more diversity training for employees. But of all the things I'm looking at, that is the most critical, building up that manager capability.
No, do you have any tips on that, Frank? I mean, seeing the potential in someone who is not like you or not like me. I certainly, in my experience, I try to be in that person's mind, walk in their shoes, understand their history, and understand their life. How have they dealt with what life has presented them with? And I always feel like if you look at someone's behavior, in whatever situation they're in, there's lots of insights.
So what you just said for me suggests you're already on the leading edge of all of this, because just having the willingness to want to understand other people and to spend the time and have that consideration, that's far ahead of most people. Most people would say, within whatever time period I have at work, I treat everyone the same. It's the equality mindset. I give everyone the same amount of time. I give them the same opportunity to perform. And no, I don't spend more time trying to get beneath the surface, and because I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a therapist, I won't do it. And so I think you're light years ahead already on that. And I don't have really much to add to that, because I think it is that kind of curiosity and sense of wanting to know more about people that actually is core to it. And the reason I said we're not fully there is because what I don't know, Jim, is can you teach that? I'm sure there's a way to do it. There's a way to trigger it. I just haven't figured it out yet. And I'm sure someone has. And I would love to hear, what it is that triggers that kind of desire to be connected to others, to understand their plight. The empathy that that's necessary. To put yourself in a position of understanding what people are thinking and feeling, so that you can better serve them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Frank, the answer to that one. I do feel like once you've experienced working in a team, a company that values diversity, equity, and inclusion and builds teams based on that, you never go back. Once you feel it, you don't want to work in any other way. So if we can have more people have that experience, and I think that's kind of happening with the younger generation, which you've talked about, and I feel very positive about that, because I was working for a company I was very fortunate because they believed in diversity, equity, inclusion, and they believed in global career paths, and they believed in putting people in cultures they're not familiar with, and I loved it, and I could not work a different way now.
Right. Yeah, it is that kind of thing, right? Once you see it and once you're exposed to it, you're forever changed. And I think a lot of it is that giving people that exposure, but a lot of it is that leadership. You worked for a company where people say, we value this. And if you don't believe we value it, watch how we move people around that we value the most in the company. Watch how we compensate people when they do the right thing. That's where everyone's looking at that. And so, yeah. Look, I'm optimistic. And I do feel like, even though I started off with this conversation saying it's been a long time that we've been trying to make change, I am optimistic, and I do feel like this time is different. And I think it's the E in DEI that actually makes the difference, right? Because we're moving from that mindset of giving everyone the same thing to give people what they need to succeed. And that's a massive shift in our thinking. And I think that's going to pay dividends down the line.
Your website is the front door of your business. But the way teams build and optimize it is simply broken. Stuck between inflexible templates and cumbersome code-dependent solutions, there's a better, faster way. Enter Webflow, a visual-first platform that empowers you to create freely. Experience a CMS where you can build dynamic content without code. Native localization that lets you translate your site in one click to reach global audiences. And third-party apps and integrations so you can build faster. Now you can ship web pages in weeks instead of months and save millions in development costs. These are the real results for companies like Orange Theory, Dropbox, and IDEO. Get started today at webflow.com. Webflow, more than a website builder. How else will you know we're making progress? You're optimistic, but what are the signs, either within BlackRock or in society at large? And I know the numbers are part of it, but what are the signs that this is changing and this time is different?
Some of it is purely the numbers. And the numbers aren't that difficult. It should not be that difficult in terms of identifying and attracting talent to bring them into the company initially. But you need to cross a critical mass in order for people to feel comfortable in any particular culture. And so, and for people to speak up and feel like it's safe for them to speak up. So for me, the first threshold is, do we have a critical mass across different areas of diversity in the company? The second one for me, it will be whether it's how managers explain their role in diversity and inclusion. If I asked today, I would get a mixture of responses. Hey, I'm doing it because I think it's the right thing to do. Don't believe it helps business at all. I'm doing it because I'm being forced to do it. Some will say, like, no, this is the answer that we've been waiting for, and I'm going to unlock massive potential by doing this. The more people you hear going down the ladder path, and the more people who avoid the kind of zero sum racial thinking that if I help someone from this group, then my group will be hurt. That to me will be massive progress. It's hard to ferret that part of it out. It's more of that one will become more anecdotal. But the next one for me would be who are getting the assignments within the company that are perceived as the prime roles within the company. And forget senior executive roles for a second, because I'm not even going there. I'm just like, these are the roles that people say, well, if you're in that role, it positions you well to advance within the company. I'd like to get an evaluation of that and see if we're improving in terms of percentages of people of color in those positions. Then I look at the senior levels and see what percentages we have at those levels. So that to me is how I would evaluate it. And there's one last check that may seem odd, but it's one that I think it may be the most important of all. And that is when someone diverse exits the company, learning from that experience and what we do around that. So you could say we do a one-off exit interview, or you can pull together a committee of people and say, like, so let's evaluate this person's whole experience over the life cycle they had within the company. From the moment we brought them in, how we developed them, what happened in promotion and compensation, and why did they leave, and what did they say, and what would we do differently as a result of this? And so that we become a learning organization. That to me will become, that's more important than any metric that I would give you.
I'll just share a thought. It's from my alma mater, Procter & Gamble. This happened after I left, but they, and P&G's tried to do the right thing in DE&I for a long time. Progress is not what they wanted it to be, nor is it today. They brought a bunch of African-American ex-P&G people who left the company and excelled. And they brought them back en masse. They brought a bunch of them back. And they put them around the big table and had one of them moderate, and the senior management sat behind a two-way mirror and listened. CEO's direct reports. It was a very emotional experience. And that sort of thing, it's empathetic, it's humble, it's vulnerable, and and these people, obviously, they had no axe to grind other than let's just try to help this company who we left for a variety of reasons Very powerful idea.
That is an incredibly powerful idea, Jim. I love that idea, actually. I'm going to try to lift it now because, I mean, it's perfect because they actually have no axe to grind, like you said. You know, but more important, they were successful afterwards. And so, you know, they're not bitter. They're just going to tell you exactly what they saw, how they felt. And look, and we need more of that. But I actually want to apply that. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Frank, we're going to wrap this up. I want you to offer one or two pieces of advice to the CMOs in large and small companies who want to make a difference within their culture and in society at large in diversity, equity, and inclusion.
So first, I would say, consider yourself part of the core team for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Don't think it's an HR role. Don't think it's a cultural officer's role. Consider yourself part of that core team. The skill set that you have and the insight that you can provide is invaluable. And so I think that for me is the first part. And the second part is just remember diversity, equity, and inclusion is both an internal thing and external thing. And on the external side, part of it is creating the imagery that helps us all advance, but also reducing the negative current that some employees face, so that before they walk into the office, they're experiencing things that weigh them down and drain them before they even open the door to your office. We have the capability of helping to reduce that, and I see this as a moral obligation. It's almost as if you see someone drowning, and you're a great swimmer, and you can swim them. You have the capability to help. Why would you not help? And so I think we have the capability to help. And I hope that all of us in some way find a way to be part of that solution.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you so much. It's so good to see you. And this is an even better conversation than we had 2 years ago.
I'm glad, Jim. It's always great to see you. I hope to see you in person soon, actually.
Me too. That was my conversation with Frank Cooper. And here are three takeaways from this conversation to think about in your business and life. And the first one, learn from diverse employees who leave your company. It's sad when that happens. No one wants that to happen. Regret it, turnover is the worst thing. But learn from these people on why they are leaving. Why did they leave? What didn't work out? What can you learn from it? BlackRock is great at that. They take the learning and they improve. Second takeaway, listening can be trained. BlackRock is training associates to actively listen to each other. By being fully engaged and asking questions, they're trying to build empathy skills for their employees and decision makers in an effort to improve their DE&I efforts. Third takeaway, rethink who can be what. Let's face it, there are preconceived notions and unconscious biases about what roles certain people should be in based on age, race, and skin tone. But Frank and his team are actively challenging their partners about rethinking who can be what at BlackRock. To learn more about DE&I, please visit the links in our show notes. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you like the show, tell a friend, and remember to rate and review us wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast DE&I miniseries is a Gallery Media Group original production in partnership with Deloitte Digital.